I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Israelis in Sirat, a town bordering Gaza, celebrated on Thursday the news of the killing of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar. A woman handed out sweets and a DJ played music in the street while people danced with Israeli flags. Israel says it killed Hamas's top leader during a strike in Gaza. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
Yahya Sinwar does not appear to have been the target. Israeli forces discovered his body in the aftermath. But from Jerusalem, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel has settled an account with Sinwar to Berlin.
It's a good day for the world.
President Biden says he congratulated Netanyahu and is now more hopeful about a ceasefire. Sinwar was one of the architects of Hamas's October attack on Israel that set off the Gaza war. Netanyahu, though, says Sinwar's death does not mean the war is over, while White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says Sinwar was a key obstacle to a ceasefire deal. Israel's pitching this as a moment for Hamas to surrender and release hostages. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Israeli military released drone video showing what it said were Sinwar's last moments. In a room wrecked by shelling, a man sat in a chair, his face covered with a cloth, possibly to hide his identity. The video showed the man with one wounded hand throwing a stick at the drone. Israeli military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said the military then fired an additional shell at the building, causing it to collapse and killing Sinwar. He said Sinwar was found with a bulletproof vest, grenades, and 40,000 shekels, nearly $11,000. This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky pitched his victory plan to the European Union and NATO in Brussels on Thursday. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reports.
If our partners will not lose their unity, we will not lose.
He got a pledge of continued support from NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte during a joint press conference, but no endorsement from key allies of his call for an immediate NATO membership invitation.
I look forward to the day that Ukraine is here as a member of this alliance. And until then, we will continue to do all that we can to assure Ukraine prevails.
Zelensky has argued that formally inviting Ukraine to join NATO would make clear to Russia that its president, Vladimir Putin, could not win. But NATO has said Ukraine cannot join while at war. Putin has cited Ukraine's potential NATO membership as a reason for the invasion.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. Africa's top public health agency said Thursday the number of Mpox-related deaths on the continent has surpassed 1,000 and warned of the continuing threat of cross-border contamination and a lack of rapid test kits. The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there were 50 Mpox-related deaths in the past week, bringing the total to 1,100, indicating authorities face a challenge in stemming outbreaks currently affecting 18 of the continent's 55 nations. An Argentine prosecutor said Thursday former One Direction singer Liam Payne died due to multiple traumas and bleeding caused by a fall, revealing the first official results of the star's autopsy as fans around the world mourn his death. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn reports.
This is the 911 call made from the Argentine hotel where British singer and former One Direction member Liam Payne was found dead. A hotel employee tells the operator that there's a guest intoxicated by drugs and alcohol. They say he's breaking the whole room and that they are afraid he might do something that will put his life at risk. It was later that evening that police say Payne fell from the third floor balcony of his hotel room. The 31-year-old singer rose to fame with One Direction, one of the world's biggest selling boy bands. Details surrounding his death remained unclear, though Payne had spoken publicly about his struggles with mental health and using alcohol to cope with the pressures of fame.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua has been removed from office.
What they have failed in is delinking the Deputy President from the political culpability or responsibility in the number of the offenses leveled against him.
Nigeria plans to review gasoline transport safety protocols after a deadly blast. Botswana's electoral body warns the opposition about making Reagan claims. A move to overthrow the Speaker of Liberia's House of Representatives leads to a fist fight.
The Speaker's action of unilaterally creating new committees and various departments in the House of Representatives without the approval of the plenary renders him administratively incompetent of presiding over the Honorable House of Representatives.
And a look at how Hurricanes Helene and Milton might impact the 2024 voting in the U.S. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua was removed from office on Thursday after being impeached last week in the National Assembly. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo-Krando has the details.
A dramatic day came to a close as Kenyan lawmakers voted to proceed with the impeachment of Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua even after he fell ill. The Senate approved 5 of the 11 charges against Gachagua, immediately removing him from office, the Speaker of the Senate, Amason Kingi, announced a little before midnight. Gachagua, who was supposed to testify on his own behalf, was admitted to the hospital with what his lawyers described as severe chest pains before he could do so. The proceedings were suspended but eventually resumed. In the end, the senators voted on 11 charges, including accusations of gross misconduct, irregular acquisition of wealth, undermining the president, among others. Gachagua has denied all the charges. Jarvis Bigambo, a Kenyan lawyer and governance consultant, watched the proceedings.
The deputy president and his lawyers were working so hard to remove the aspect of criminal liability of the DP and his interests. That one, actually, they have succeeded convincingly. But that is not what impeachment is all about. What they have failed in is delinking the deputy president from the political culpability or responsibility in the number of the offenses leveled against him.
Gachagua's lawyers walked out of the Senate chamber when their plea to adjourn the proceedings to next Tuesday was rejected. Another motion to postpone the proceedings to Saturday to meet a 10-day constitutional deadline was defeated as well. On the Senate floor, some lawmakers argued against impeaching Gachagua. They said some of the accusations were unfounded and not enough proof had been given to impeach the DP. Some said they wished Gachagua could have been present to answer the accusations in person. Bigambo says this is a historic moment for Kenya, the region, and constitutional democracy. The president could nominate a new deputy within 14 days and send a name to the National Assembly, which would then have 60 days to approve it. But Bigambo says things might move much faster.
And looking at the mastery of statecraft as it's playing out, it is possible that tomorrow morning the president will convey a DP nominee to the National Assembly. And because the National Assembly is having a special sitting tomorrow, it is possible that the National Assembly may consider the nominee tomorrow because next week they are going on recess. And that nominee may be sworn in by Saturday because nothing stops that.
Bigambo added that if Gachagua is hoping to challenge his impeachment in court, his earliest opportunity would be after a national holiday on Monday. By that time, Bigambo said, a new deputy president could already be in office. Meanwhile, the doctor who treated Gachagua told the media outside the hospital that his condition was stable, but he would be kept at the hospital for observation for about 48 to 72 hours. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
There was a fist fight in Liberia's House of Representatives on Thursday as one group of lawmakers signed a resolution to remove Speaker J. Fonati Kofa. Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia.
It was a chaotic scene on Thursday when lawmakers jumped into a fist fight after one group accused the other of a plot to remove Speaker Kofar. The incident, which disrupted the legislative session, took place between a group of lawmakers from the ruling Unity Party and the former ruling Coalition for Democratic Change, CDC Party. Representative Yan Flomo read the six-count petition to remove the speaker, including conflict of interest.
The speaker's action of unilaterally creating new committees and various departments in the House of Representatives without the approval of the plenary, the higher decision-making body, renders him administratively incompetent of presiding over the Honorable House of Representatives. Now, therefore, upon our approbation, as the below signature, that the Speaker of the House of Representatives, J. Fulani Kofar, be exposed to a vote of non-confidence, and if the process goes through, he be removed.
Representative Marvin Cole, who led the opposing bloc in support of the speaker, tells the VOA that the other lawmakers are proceeding unlawfully.
But resolution is not a process. It's not the only process to remove speaker. The law is clear. Article 38 states any rule that you adapt, any of the chambers adapt to govern there, it should be in conformity with the Constitution of the Republic of Liberia. Constitution of the Republic states, Article 38, that you should give every individual due process. You are presumed innocent until proven guilty.
Reports in the local media said that each of the lawmakers received $15,000 to sign the resolution to remove the speaker. Former President George Weah has condemned the alleged plot, calling it undemocratic. Eugene Namwe is the chief of staff in the office of former President Weah.
Former President Weah issued a statement merely to condemn the use of government money to illegally try to remove Speaker Kofar so as to advance the selfish interests of the Unity Party. This is a threat to democracy, so the former president is again sounding a caveat, not just to the UP, but to the Liberian people, that Liberia has a teeming democratic system and we all should do whatever it takes to preserve it.
Deputy Information Minister Daniel Sando tells the VOA that former President Weah's comment is misleading, noting that the Bwaka administration is not involved.
The accusations coming from the CDC are completely disrespectful, preposterous, and unfounded. The Bwaka-led administration is more focused on very important matters confronting the country at this time. The government is absolutely not connected to any plot that is being effectuated on Capitol Hill as far as the removal of the Speaker of the House of Representatives is concerned.
The incident has sparked a heated discussion across the country. Some speculate that the plot to remove Speaker Kofar is due to his recent quest to audit the House of Representatives. Others think that Kofar, as an opposition speaker, has become too close to President Bwaka instead of opposing him. For Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipson in Monrovia, Liberia.
Authorities in Nigeria have announced plans to review safety protocols for the transportation of gasoline after a deadly tanker accident and explosion killed more than 140 on Wednesday. President Bola Tinubu said the review will be swift and comprehensive, but some observers are skeptical that safety standards will improve. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
President Bola Tinubu's announcement comes in the wake of the petrol tanker blast Wednesday in Nigeria's Jigawa state. A tanker crashed in the village of Majia and a short time later burst into flames, killing and injuring many who had gathered around the wreckage to scoop up spilled fuel. Tinubu said a review of transport protocols for gasoline will be carried out in partnership with various state authorities and that offenders of the new regulations will be punished. It is not clear what the new regulations will be. The president also sent top government officials, including his defense and transportation ministers, along with food aid and medical supplies to the site of Wednesday's crash. Economic analyst Ezo Nyegbere says he doesn't expect any new measures from authorities.
It's a very unfortunate situation and position because the leadership of the country has not been proactive about planning for transportation of petroleum, whether it's crude oil or refined petroleum, the government is not known to think through issues. They just latch on when there's a public outburst.
The accident in Jigawa comes barely 1 month after another tanker exploded after it collided with a truck in Niger State, killing 48 people. President Tinubu has ordered the Federal Road Safety Corps, or FRSC, to strengthen enforcement of already existing road transport protocols, including regulations on night travels and official patrols. Energy expert Chukwudi Victor Odermi says the new measures are welcome, but is skeptical about compliance.
The federal government thinking at this point that it's a time to put policies in place is a good one. But then the only snag I see in it is compliance.
No, I think
it has to do with enforcement. And it's not actually about the laws, because load limits have always been there, but it has never been enforced. So they have to do a lot of enforcement. I don't think it's in creating new policies.
Nigeria's 5,000 kilometers of oil pipelines are often prone to vandalism, and petrol suppliers mostly rely on tankers to transport fuel around the country. But due to poorly maintained roads and disregard for existing road measures, tanker accidents are common. Onyebere says the government needs to repair and protect the pipelines.
If those pipelines were secured and maintained, that would have been the cheapest and easiest way of transporting these things in such a way and manner that will not have exposed Nigerians to a lot of risk.
In 2020, more than 500 people died from about 1,500 tanker accidents, according to the FRSC. Many will be watching to see if and how authorities enforce any new measures designed to prevent accidents and protect lives. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 18. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Botswana's electoral body has warned opposition parties against what it calls reckless claims of poll rigging ahead of the October 30th general election. A coalition of opposition parties accused the country's Independent Electoral Commission of, among other infractions, adding deceased persons to the voter roll. Mkudise Dube reports from Habaruni, Botswana.
The IEC Chief Public Relations Officer Osupile Maroba says the electoral body is concerned with claims by the opposition that dead people have been placed on the roll of registered voters. In Maroba's words, the allegations are false, disrespectful and absurd. But Moeti Moasai, spokesperson for the opposition coalition Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, insists his party knows about plans to rig the election. He says the Electoral Commission is enlisting the services of Zimbabwean authorities.
The IEC is working in collaboration with the Electoral Commission of Zimbabwe to assist it in the games that they master most, cheating in elections. Central Intelligence Organization of Zimbabwe is working with the Directorate of Intelligence Services and Security in Botswana to also achieve the same.
Moasa says the UTC will petition the Zimbabwean embassy in Habron next week over their election concerns. The Botswana Congress Party, which is contesting outside the opposition alliance, is equally concerned the poll will be marred by irregularities. BCP spokesperson Paul Peko says their worry is particularly with the counting of votes away from polling stations.
The BCP has always held the position that elections in Botswana are free but not fair. Recently, the president of the BCP, Dumelan Salishando, proposed a motion before closure of 12th Parliament, suggesting for the law to be reviewed to allow for ballots, to be counted where voting happened. But the BDP, as usual, the majority refused, insisting on transportation of ballot boxes.
Kalalelo Kinzi of the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, BDP, says the opposition's claims are a sign of desperation. Kinzi says the opposition made the same assertions during the 2019 election but could not prove them in court. Burundi-based Raphael Bindariye is program manager at the Netherlands Institute for Multiparty Democracy, who previously worked as an electoral officer in United Nations missions in Africa. He says opposition concerns over election rigging in Africa emanate from how electoral bodies are managed.
It's the how impartial, how independent, how natural the electoral management bodies are in Africa. How are they set up? Who is setting them up? Where they get results from? It is generally from the government. It is generally from the ruling parties, which have more means and which is the one managing the resources, the national resources in the country.
More than 2,000 Botswana citizens living abroad, together with local election officials and police, will cast votes this Saturday. The rest of the more than 1 million local voters will get their turn on October 13. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
The United Nations envoy to Western Sahara has proposed dividing the territory between Morocco and the pro-independence Polisario Front in order to resolve the decades-old conflict, according to the French news agency, the AFP. Stéphane de Mistura told a closed session of the UN Security Council on Wednesday that he had discreetly revisited and expanded with all concerned on the concept of a partition of the territory. Western Sahara is largely controlled by Morocco, but the Algeria-backed Polisario Front has campaigned for independence for the territory since before colonial ruler Spain pulled out in 1975. The Ivory Coast government announced on Thursday the dissolution of all student union associations after the killing of two people allegedly by members of a powerful student group. President Alassane Ouattara chaired a National Security Council meeting to approve the measure, which targets, in particular, the Ivory Coast Student and School Federation. The French news agency AFP reports that the group has been accused of terrorizing campuses in Abidjan, the country's biggest city. The U.S. states of Florida, North Carolina, and Georgia are dealing with the aftermath of two major hurricanes that killed hundreds of people and caused tens of billions of dollars in damage. With the presidential election less than a month away and the race extremely close, White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadikuswara looks at how the storms might impact voting in these states.
States hit hard by Hurricane Helene in late September and Milton earlier this month are trying to return to normal, with power restored to most areas and ongoing debris removal. President Joe Biden visited impacted areas in Florida earlier this week, encouraging people to come together.
Not as Democrats or Republicans, but as Americans. Americans who need help, and Americans who help you if you were in the same situation.
It's hard to separate storm response from the politics that surrounds it. Studies show that voters reward the incumbent's party when the federal government comes through with disaster relief and punish them when it doesn't. Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris has been highlighting the Biden administration's efforts.
I have spoken with state, local officials, both Republican and Democrat, to let them know we will be with you every step of the way as you recover and rebuild.
While her Republican rival Donald Trump has spread misinformation about the federal government's response, claiming that it has avoided Republican areas and it used up relief funding to help illegal immigrants.
The federal government, on the other hand, has not done what you're supposed to be doing, in particular with respect to North Carolina. They've let those people suffer unjustly.
The Atlantic hurricane season peaks in the months right before the November election. For decades, officials have built disaster contingencies into their election planning. But now they must also deal with disinformation. Kim Wyman, senior fellow with Bipartisan Policy Center's Elections Project, via Zoom.
Well, I think that's the biggest challenge that election officials in particular are facing right now in the aftermath of these hurricanes, because we are seeing on social media people making wild claims about, the ability for voters to cast a ballot, the impact that the hurricanes had on the election, and that voting will not take place now because of it. And so we really encourage voters to go to trusted sources.
Politics aside, with some roads still inaccessible, buildings damaged, and people busy rebuilding their lives, voter turnout could be lower. Storm damage could also impact people's plans to vote via mail, which is allowed in some states. Almost all states offer some form of early voting. Even without complications from Mother Nature, officials and activists have encouraged people to take that option. Chastity Malloy from the Georgia Conservation Voters Education Fund via Zoom.
It gives you more dates to cast your ballot instead of being beholden to election day only. Because no one can really forecast if another major storm will impact our area or another kind of environmental crisis that may belabor our ability to cast our ballots here in Georgia.
With the race extremely close in two storm-impacted states, Georgia and North Carolina, officials in some counties have allowed greater flexibility to enable people to vote. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the Confederation of African Football announcing that the official draw for the final tournament of the CAF Women's Champions League Morocco 2024 will take place at the Complex Mohammed VI in Saleh, Morocco on Friday. The final tournament will be held from the 9th to the 23rd of November 2024. The fourth edition of the tournament will feature five doubletons, including Aigles de la Medina of Senegal, Edo Queens of Nigeria, University of the Western Cape from South Africa, Tutankhamun from Egypt, and CBEFC from Ethiopia. In cricket news, Australia suffered a shock semi-final exit from the T20 World Cup as South Africa raced to an emphatic 8-wicket win in Dubai on Thursday. Australia were pre-tournament favourites. The South Africans had never beaten them in the T20 World Cup, including losing last year's final against them in Cape Town, and the odds were stacked against the South Africans. The defending champions missed out on an 8th final appearance as the Proteas reached their target of 135 with 16 balls to spare. Aneke Bosch struck a sensational unbeaten 74 from 48 balls, while captain Laura Wolverdutt added a classy 42 in a second wicket partnership of 96 that left Australia reeling. In motorsports, at least 28 drivers will compete in the forthcoming 2024 Rwanda Mountain Gorilla Rally scheduled for October 18th to the 20th. The annual car race, which crosses over Kigali and Bugesera route, is one of the components of the African Championship. Kenyan star driver Karen Patel is expected to take part in the annual competition, hoping to retain after winning the 2023 edition. Should he win it, he could be confirmed winner of the 2024 African Rally Championship for the second time in a row. This year's edition will attract drivers from four African countries, namely host Rwanda, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda. And now to Kenya, where the inaugural Sports Tech Africa Conference, which ended on Thursday in Nairobi, is expected to become the hub for sports science and technology conversation. The conference brought together various sports stakeholders, including government officials, sports federations, private sector, athletes, and the media. Sport Tech Africa co-founder Kiruba Momoyanyi insists that it is only the stakeholders themselves that can move the industry from the stone age in which it is currently stuck.
We're very excited to be hosting the first ever Sports Tech Africa conference. It's very important for the continent to get this conversation going because we are noticing that we are lagging behind from the rest of the world in the sports world, where things that should be basically we're falling behind because we're not including enough technology in our conversations.
And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, October 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Mbote in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba-ba-ba-zip.